Okay, we are starting chapter 10 as to an accumulative review of what we did till now. In chapter 1, he asked a bunch of questions, which those questions begin to get answered in chapter 12. So we'll worry about those. I'll review the questions when we get back to chapter 12.
Fair.
But introduces the concept in chapter, the end of chapter 1, that there's everybody would have, be a whole lot easier if everybody just had one soul. But we have two souls. And soul number one is called the animal soul. It is given to us at birth. And from it come all the desires and passions and foibles that man is accustomed to.
Indeed.
And he said, and by the way, the Jews have this nice animal soul. We got nice animals, so we like to do nice things too. Chapter 2, he talks about the godly soul. And the godly soul is a portion of godliness. And
literally a piece.
Literally a portion of infinity.
Right.
And it is the equalizer among all Jews. Because we all have basically the same point of godliness. Because once you have a point of infinity, this can't be any different than any other point of infinity.
It's not like you can weigh it out or measure it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So my infinity is bigger than your infinity.
The essence of the soul is this portion of God. And he goes and asks different questions. How could it be? You have different souls and levels. And he gives an example that, well, look at your own body. You got one body with one soul in it. Yet you have a head, you have eyes, you have a mouth, you have legs. Each different body part has different functions and different amounts of, you might say, qualitative or quantitative soul within them.
Right.
Okay, you have things that are called vital organs, and you have things that people could live without. Okay, so you have people like a Moshe, and you have people like a Herschel Finman. It's two different things, but it's all part of the same spark. Chapter 3, he says, how is the soul, what is the composite of the soul, the composition of it? It is made up of emulating when it says, God said, let us make man in our image. So the Almighty has 10 divine attributes, and we are patterned after that, and we have 10 soul attributes. 3 intellectual, known as Chabad, and 7 emotional, which are Chagas Nehim, Chesed Gvur Teferis, Nesachot Yisrael, and Malchus. And describes there, how do we go about tapping into our godly soul? It says you got to sit down, you have to think. Something which is very hard for most people, just to stop and sit and think.
Mm.
The expression, I stopped to think once and forgot to start. Right.
We've
so
never done that.
And the different faculties of the intellect is mostly discussed in chapter 3. Chapter 4, well, how does the soul manifest itself in the body? Are through what he refers to as the garments of the soul, thought, speech, and action.
Mm.
And that's the way the soul, in its pristine state, which is not relevant and relatable to a physical world or even a body that it's enclosed in, has to first present itself in these quote-unquote garments, which are expressions of the Torah, the thought, thinking about the Torah, speaking about the Torah, and doing the Torah and the mitzvahs. And that's how the godly soul can be manifest itself in the body. Chapter 5 is a parenthetical statement, whereby he talks about the idea of grasping a concept. The word grasping is something that you do with your hand.
Right.
Concepts you can't hold in your hand. Yet he explains, this is the same word as tefisa, the same word in Hebrew, meaning to grasp, means that, excuse me, when a person can formulate it in their mind and they can picture it, that's called grasping. And introduces this idea that the importance of learning Torah, and as it says in Perkei Avos, that an Ama Aretz, an ignorant person cannot be pious, can't be a chassid, and talked about the reason and just in one very quick line, the motive behind our learning is lishma, doing it for the sake of Hashem, because the Torah needs to be learned, rather than some ulterior motive. He goes into ulterior motives later on, I want to say chapter 43, I think, and talks about there how bad it is for a person to have ulterior motives. That I'm going to learn so that in order that I can become A.
Yes.
And ultimately, the person should learn because the Torah has to be learned. If we're not going to learn it, who's going to learn it?
Right.
Chapter 6, he introduces the concept, first of all, of the animal soul, which we talked about in chapter 1, and talks about where it's rooted in the forces of evil, which we call klippa, and sitra achra. Klippa means a shell. Mm-hmm. A shell is a protective outer cover, and not necessarily a bad thing. However, what happened when Adam ate from the fruit, the protective cover around the garment, which was the klippa, which was the shell, crumbled into the world. And so the world became filled with this klippa, with this shell. And Adam was therefore given the job. You made a mess. You got to clean it up.
It's the pancake batter when the eggs are in, when the eggshells are inside.
Eggshell in the omelet, yes.
Yes, that's...
Okay. And we have to, we're in charge of picking out all those little eggshell pieces.
Yes.
That's our job, and that's called tikkun olam. It's called making the world a better place. So that concept is introduced in chapter 6, that there are different... the animal soul is comprised of, is a mirror image of the animal soul. The animal soul is a mirror image of the godly soul. It has intellect, emotions, garments. And when a person engages in an animalistic pleasure of some sort, fulfilling an animalistic desire, so then they are attaching themselves, or firstly detaching themselves from the forces of holiness, and attaching themselves to the forces of unholiness. Thus gives strength to, is directs the godliness, which is supposed to go into a person's godly soul, into the forces of evil. And then the forces of evil give him back a little bit just to keep him going, so he can go do more evil, so he can keep them stronger. Hmm. Chapter 7, he talks about the idea of elevatable evil. Elevatable evil means anything that we are allowed to use. The word evil being a Christian word, not really a good one.
Right.
But it's not, in according to Tanya, either it's holy or it's unholy. There is no middle ground.
No gray.
Something which is what we would consider not holy, not unholy, fits into the category of what is referred to as klippas noga, which means elevatable evil.
Right.
And this category is whatever we do with it. If we consume food gluttonously, so we have caused the godliness, which is contained within this item, to sink into the realm of absolute evil. If we use that item for some holy purpose, so then we cause that item to, and the godliness which is enclosed in it, to be elevated to holiness. That is where our function in the world is finding all of the usable items in the world and utilizing them to serve Hashem. Chapter 8 is, you could say it's a side point, also talks, continue with the idea of evil, that says, let's say a person consumed something that was not kosher, didn't know about it. And he even went, and he went and he studied, and he learned, and he did mitzvahs, all from the
energy
that he got from this not kosher food. So he says, sorry. That's the definition of unkosher. The word asur, meaning forbidden, means tied down in Hebrew.
Right.
That the energy, the godliness which is in that item, is tied down in the realm of unholiness, and we cannot elevate it. Even if it was only accidental, and even if a person went and did something good with it, went and fulfilled a holy purpose. Sorry.
Right.
If you make tefillin out of rhinoceros skin, it's not even possible. You couldn't even consider it unfit. It's a nothing. It's a toy.
It's a toy. Right.
Okay? It's a TLO, tefillin-like object.
Right.
But it's not tefillin.
Right.
Okay? So then, chapter 9, he sets the stage. This is where now we've given enough background information. And in chapter 9, he sets the stage and says The animal soul's in the heart, on the left side. The godly soul's in the brain, but also manifests itself in the left side. So the heart now becomes a battleground, dominance over the heart. So it says, when behold, you should love Hashem, you should love Hashem with all your heart. Rashi comments there, with both your evil inclination and your good inclination, to get your animal soul to like, to love doing things for Hashem also.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's where the battleground stage is. And in chapter 9, he continues on to say that it is important that we stay focused, because when we are focused and doing things for Hashem, then we become a vehicle for holiness, we convey holiness, and we, quote unquote, we become holy. If, however, a person is, he says this later on in chapter 23. So at the end of chapter 9, oh yes, he explains all the different functions of the godly soul. That's what it is. I was mixing something up from another class that I had. So the whole function of the godly soul is to get the body to do exactly what it wants it to do.
Right, what the godly soul wants it to do.
What the godly soul wants it to do is wants to be in complete control. And what does the animal soul want? In one line he says, and the animal soul, it wants to be in complete control too.
Right.
So our bodies now become, he says, like a small city with two kings waging war over the control over it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that takes us now to chapter 10. So vehine, now we're going to give some definitions now. So vehine kishadim magbir nashu helikis. When a person strengthens his godly soul, v'nilcham kol kach im habahamis, and he fights so hard with his animal soul, ad shem megarash mevar harash ba mechol smali, until he drives out and burns up the evil which is in his left ventricle and his heart. As it says, and you shall destroy, you shall burn out the evil which is in your midst. But the evil wasn't completely converted to good. This person is called a tzaddik who is not complete, or a tzaddik and he has evil. In the first chapter, when he introduced this concept of different types of people, said that there are three types of people, tzaddik, beinoni, and rasha. And tzaddik and rasha are divided into two. You have a tzaddik v'tovlei, which is also called a tzaddik gomer. And you have a tzaddik v'ra lo, which is also called a tzaddik, which is not complete. And he says over there, for example, tzaddik of virala, what does it mean, a tzaddik and he's got bad? Because it means he's got, you have a tzaddik and he's got suffering. Okay, that's not what the word, that's not what it means. Even though it translates it in the English as a tzaddik virala, as a righteous man who suffers. Okay, that could be, that translation could imply a person who's a totally righteous person, a tzaddik gomer.
Right.
And for some reason, he's...
afflicted.
Not doing so good in this world, with the physical world.
Right, okay.
But that's not what this is.
Okay.
So tzaddik v'ra'la, he sort of explains in Ramah, Raya Mehenesha, harasha by kafaf l'tayv, that he has evil, but it is dormant, subjugated to the good.
Right.
Like it isn't even there. It's not bothering him. Okay? So that's what you have over here. That means to say, sheyesh ba dayan ma'at mezer rabuchal esmali. He has a little bit of evil in him still. But only that evil that he has in him is nullified. Bent and nullified to the good.
Right.
It's not posing him any problems. Okay, it's not like we say, you know, a person says, I think a person went, how's it go? First, I went to the Baal Shem Tov and said, I am plagued with Machshava Zoras, which, you know what a Machshava Zora is, right? Okay. Which literally, the word Machshava Zora means, we translated it as a foreign thought or an inappropriate thought. The less, the literal translation of the Zohar is a strange thought.
Right, okay.
So he went and complained to the Baal Shem Tov. He's plagued with Machshava Zaros. And he said, foreign thoughts? What are you talking about? So for you, those are domestic. Those are right at home. Those aren't foreign. Aye, aye, aye.
That's not good.
So the... So when a person, you know, so a person has to know.
I can only relate too well. That's why that's so funny.
Okay.
Nerds.
You know, there are several such stories by the Baal Shem Tov like that. A guy came to the Baal Shem Tov and said that he saw in a sefer that if you don't speak Dvarim B'Talem for 40 days, you'll see Eliyahu.
Mm, yeah.
So he said, I did it, I didn't see. So the Baal Shem Tov said to him, did you daven every day? He said, I davened every day. And he said, did you say Tillim? He said, I said Tillim every day. He said, those were your Dvarim B'Talem. Those were your empty words.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, ouch.
That hurts. Okay. El Shekav HaBadol L'Tayv Machmas Miyutav Alachin Nid Malay Ber Ki Vayager Shevayelech L'Kula L'Gamri. Since it is so small and he isn't so in control of it, it appears to him as though he has driven it out and it is gone completely.
Yeah.
Avol Be'emes, in truth, Ilu Chalav HaHalach L'Gamri Kol HaRasha Bay, if it would be that all of the evil would be totally driven away, Hayin HaHapach L'Tayv Mamash, then he would have been, he would have been totally good.
Yeah, the evil would have been converted.
Correct.
Right.
Okay. Now, in this, he doesn't exactly say it over here, but what's the difference between a tzaddik and a beinoni? Is the tzaddik's job in the world is different than that of the beinoni. God made people, for the most part, God made tzaddikim. The tzaddikim, right, the known tzaddikim that are in the world were born that way.
Right.
Ger Hasidim have a story. I think it was the Ger Hasidim. Mm. They had a Rebbe who was very, I think I told you this, and they had a Rebbe who became Rebbe when he was 12.
Yeah, go ahead. That's a good story.
And someone asked some other, how could you have a Rebbe who's 12 years old? You know, how are you going to follow him? So he says, he gives an example. You have a guy who's an experienced mountain climber, and he takes on the hardest peak. Okay, what number would we call that, Alex? What kind of peak? You're really hard. He's got to like do a hand over hand, and he's got to make sure he's got the spikes in, and he's got the ropes, the whole business over here, and he's really huffing and puffing over here, and he gets up to the top, and he sees a little kid.
Mm.
And he says, I had to work so hard to get here. How did you get up here? The kid says, simple. I was born here.
Right. Right.
So the tzaddikim are born that way.
Right, right, exactly.
I don't know what you call it.
Hmm?
I don't know what you call it.
No? Okay. Tzaddikim are born that way. And there are many stories. I think I've told them before. Mm-hmm. One of these days I'll get them up on my website and you can hear them all again.
Cool.
Anyway, so the job of the tzaddik, since the tzaddik was made that way, their job is his hapcha. The Alter Rebbe did write a book called Sefer Shel Tzaddikim. It was lost in a fire. The world wasn't ready for it,
yeah.
Okay, it had to be a tzaddik. Okay, who would have read the book?
Yeah. Who could read the book?
A dozen people?
Yeah.
Burn your eyes out.
Yeah. All six of them? Yeah.
Yeah, you know, so...
Or 36 of them, maybe.
It's like there's a book that every house has to have. It's called Radzil HaMalach. You have such a book? Radzil the Angel.
Uh-uh.
It was written by Adam.
Uh-huh.
When Adam was kicked out of the garden, so there was this angel came and said, okay, you got to write a book. All the things that Hashem taught you.
Yeah.
Okay, he said, I want to write a book. He says, if I write a book, people are going to say, Adam, oy, that schlub, that yutz, that yold, what he got us into.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm taking this book and I'm burning it.
Right, okay, bye.
So the angel promised him that if you'll write it, I guarantee it will never burn.
Never burn.
So people give it away usually as a engagement present to chasanim.
Yeah.
So that this is like their, and it even says on the title page, this is fire insurance.
I love it.
Because since it's guaranteed, the book is never going to burn, so your house is never going to burn.
Very good.
Okay, so it's spiritual fire. Now, what it says after you get past that little introduction, mm-hmm. that every once in a while
I've never seen it.
I'll pick it up. You see where it is? It's behind a book. So like
who publishes it?
Different people publish it.
Yeah?
Yeah. I got one of the fancy gold covers simply because I could. So
I have to get such safer. I've never even heard of such safer.
I once saw it in Bornstein's actually. Esther's used to carry it all the time.
Yeah?
And he used to actually go on a campaign. Yeah? People would come in and say, you have to buy this book. And I'd say, Rabbi, I don't read Hebrew. It doesn't matter. Because what it says on the inside cover of it, like in the first chapter, is if you think you can read this, and you shouldn't be, you one of two things will happen. You will either die or you will go crazy. So there are times when I think myself a bit uppity and I think to myself...
A bit holy, yeah.
I've been around the block a couple of times.
I could read this.
I could go through it. And that line kind of like... hits me, and it's like the warning. Yeah, and I say, okay, I still think I can do this, and I'll get like another half a page in, and I'll say, nope.
Got that fixed.
I think it's behind the English form.
No, it's behind the
time. No. I think it's behind like the one that's your belly button high. I think it's behind that or below it. Yeah, it's definitely behind the books. Because I don't want it taking up shelf space. I'm never going to lose it anyway. It's just there.
It's fire insurance. You don't keep the insurance papers out of the desk.
Put it in a box with a hammer next to it, warning in case of fire.
Yeah.
Well, we'll have to find it.
All right, that's okay. Don't worry. Not to worry.
Too bad.
Wait,
you cleaned my books for Pesach. Where'd you put it? Maybe you did, I don't know.
All these books are in the little one. It's a small paperback, no?
Right. Well, it's a regular size pamphlet. It's like a pamphlet size, but it's the same size as those RJJ things. They come in different sizes. You can even get the pocket edition for your car. For the typical apartment. I saw that recently, yeah.
But we're on car fire. That would have been nice to have when my car caught on fire.
Yeah.
It was a Saturn wagon, you know, they make it some of the plastic.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. So the whole front end melted.
It melted?
Yeah, just...
Literally melted.
It's kind of cool. I can laugh about it now, but... You know, my car's sitting like dripping, you know, fire.
That's not cool.
No. But it did look kind of cool.
You should have had your camcorder out. Just you know, could have posted it on YouTube.
Trying to stay away from that, so I thought it was going to blow up on me.
It might have. Okay, anyway. So the tzaddik's job is conversion of evil to good.
Conversion.
Benoni's job, he's going to say later on, is subjugation.
Yes.
Is the translator's word. Eskafia.
Eskafia, yes.
Of controlling oneself. The tzaddik doesn't have to control himself. He can't not control himself because he doesn't have free choice.
Yeah.
He has no desire, no inclination towards evil at all. So what can he do then? So what is his job? Nobody's here to just come on here on vacation.
Uh-huh.
There's no free lunches over here. So his job is to take evil that he can and where possible convert it to good.
That's like taking a vacation in this Mojave Desert. You know, like, what do you do there?
Survive?
At best, you know.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I'll find it. I'll pull it out. Okay. An example of his hapcha involves the Rebbe and the Alter Rebbe.
Mm.
In 1970, this is a famous story. In 1970,
okay.
Air France ran its first ever sale of transatlantic flights, Paris to New York.
Okay.
$300, 1970.
Wow, that's nothing.
Then. Okay. Wow. Even then, that wasn't, you know, okay, say that
I mean, it's like, not chump change, but...
That $700, even $700 like now.
Yeah, you know, so. Yeah, that was still cheap.
So, friends didn't know what hit him.
Huh?
They didn't know what hit him.
Right.
Because suddenly there were four plane loads of French Lubavitchers who have never been to New York, who had never seen the Rebbe, suddenly now invade Crown Heights.
Yeah, 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 sure.
So not only was it Air France didn't know what hit them, but they had to add four extra planes to take everybody.
Right.
But the people in Crown Heights in 1970, the community was much smaller back
right,
then.
Right, sure, sure.
Now we're inundated with 1,200...
Yeah, double the community.
Only French-speaking people. Some of them spoke a little bit of Hebrew.
Yeah.
And how do we communicate with these people? Some of the old-time Lubavitchers spoke French, okay, good, right, because they were like... in the DP camps, you know, right, so they spoke picked up French. But for the most part, people just, they didn't become Francophiles from this experience.
Uh-huh.
Okay, now these people, because they spent all this money and it had never happened to them that they were ever in New York, so they always wanted to be like right up front.
Yeah.
So you got 1,200 people pushing to be up front.
Sure, of course.
Along with the regulars who also want to be up front.
Yeah, think they should be up front.
Yeah, so I'm up front all the time, so, you know, so... The it was quite a scenario from what I understand. It was from before I was from.
Yeah.
That Simchas Torah, the Rebbe said, I want to tell you a story. In 1812, when the Alter Rebbe was fleeing from Napoleon, he asked his brother Reb Chaim to double back and to learn the niggun, to learn this, the march of Napoleon, in which the soldiers are marching in cadence.
Right.
He, Reb Chaim had a musical talent, so we went and he listened to it, and he came back and he taught it to the Alter Rebbe.
Yeah.
And the Alter Rebbe changed a couple of notes.
Right.
And said, it is no longer Napoleon's march.
Right.
It is now a niggun.
Ooh.
2 weeks later, the Russian winter hit, and Napoleon was driven back. And the Rebbe explained that what the Alter Rebbe was able to do was to, this song, why do people sing when they're marching? In order to keep in a certain spirit
and time
that they should want to march. They're marching like this, that they should want to march, rather than they're just walking, so it gets to be a drag.
Right, right, right. It was a unity.
Yeah. So like this, what he did was, is by making it no longer Napoleon's march, he sucked out the vitality from the army, you might say, leaving only just a shell.
Wow.
And elevated it to the realm of
holiness.
And when do we sing Napoleon's march?
Yom Kippur.
At the end of Yom Kippur.
Sure.
So the Rebbe said, now there is in France a Napoleon who is worse than Napoleon. And maybe we could try, no guarantees, doing something similar. And the Rebbe started singing the French national anthem. 1,200 French Lubavitchers went wild. The Rebbe singing La Marseillaise. 2 weeks later, Pompidou died. Pompidou was the one, if you recall, you don't recall, you're too young, but I don't even know the name, Pompidou. Pompidou was the one that the Israelis bought fighter jets from, the Phantom fighter jets. They brought like 20, they bought 24 of them. And the French refused, they paid for them, they paid cash, and the French refused to deliver them because they felt that it would be an unfair imbalance to the Middle East. So the Israelis had to go and steal them. It was like one of those Mossad missions that like they make movies
right,
about.
Right. I remember.
Okay. That was who Pompidou was. And right. That was already considered lame. Compared to some of the things that he really wanted to do.
Right.
So, like this, the Rebbe sucked out the Chai. And for a while after the Pompidou died, and they got this next guy, who was Mitterrand. So for a long time, the French national anthem had changed. They got rid of it, and they got another national anthem. But the French never could catch on to that one, and they put it back to Le Marseillais. Yeah, so they do sing Le Marseillais still in France. So that's the job of what a tzaddik does.
Yeah.
A tzaddik sees evil and converts it to good. Let's just finish on the bottom of the page.
All right.
Where are we at? I think we did. Ubat l'tay machmas miyut of alachin nid malai. Therefore, it appears kivya gershay v'yalech lo kulo legamrei. It appears to him as though he had totally and completely driven it away. If he had gotten rid of it, it would have been good. Right. A tzaddik gomer, a totally righteous person, has converted the evil within his, in him to good. That's why he's called a tzaddik, and there's only good to him.
Right.
Not that he's prospering, as the translation suggests.
No, no, no.
Okay, one of the things that I can say this actually on tape, and maybe it'll get on the website, and somebody will see it and report back to the translator. But I thank the translator of the Tanya into English, because like this, I have a job explaining what he says. Okay, so it's that, not that the tzaddik is prospering. He's got a massive bank account.
Right,
he's got two stock tickers in his living room, you know,
sure.
You know, watching his portfolio. Okay. That's not what that means. But he is a tzaddik gomer. He is only good. This is by removing the filthy garments completely, meaning that this person who is a tzaddik never acts, never says, never thinks anything wrong. The Haina Lemois. Now, this is the difference, though, because the Bainin is the same thing. He's going to say later on in chapter 12.
Right.
But what's the difference here? Haina Lemois Berat Me'oid B'Tayne Yer Lemazah. To feel disgusted by the pleasures of this world. Lehis Anig Bam. To have delight in them. Now, that's the difference between us. That word, Lehis Anig Bam, to have delight in them, is the difference between Hasidus and all other philosophies. He doesn't say that you should just find the world disgusting and live a hermetical life and a life of denial. It says you should find the pleasure disgusting. That just doing something because of physical pleasure is a coarse, gross, animal act. And we are people.
Right.
The word man implies bigger than that, better than that. Okay? That he is totally disgusted by pleasures of the world. The story that the Tzemach Tzedek, when he was arrested, after he'd been arrested, the whole conference in Petersburg or Moscow, I don't remember which one it was, and he was put under house arrest 24 times during the course of this conference because he refused to back down. And eventually, it was the government that relented to him and said, okay, do what you want. So concerning Jewish education, they wanted to start a public school system then, which wasn't really instituted until the Bolsheviks took over. And he was invited to, after the whole thing was over, he was invited to an official affair of state. And he walked into this huge mansion, one of these, like, you know, a Dostoevsky-esque type mansion with a description over there with a huge ballroom in the business. He walks in and the hostess comes to greet him and she's wearing a low-cut dress. And the Tzemach Tzedek said, excuse me for a second, please, and went to the balcony and threw up because of this act of immodesty.
Wow.
He was so disgusted by such a thing.
Wow.
Okay. Bam b'taynugis b'nei adam l'malis taivis haguf bilvad. That the only reason why they're doing this, he's disgusted by people who only do things to fulfill their physical pleasures. V'loy l'avodas Hashem. He doesn't say you can't eat brownies. You could eat brownies, but you have to eat them to serve Hashem. Because since all the pleasures of the world, all the physical world is derived from klippa, the part that we are able to use, we said before, is that part which is elevatable. Anything which is from the forces of evil, the totally righteous person hates them with an ultimate hatred. Why does he hate them? Is because they are in opposition to Elokus. The tzaddik loves God so much that anything which is contradictory to Hashem is hated, despised, disgusted. Because they are opposite of what Hashem wants. Could exceed Tachlis Sina Senesim. David Melech said in Tillim, with an ultimate hatred, a consummate hatred, I hate them. La'avim hayuli, count them among my enemies. Chekrani, search Vidal Levavi, and know my heart that I haven't got a single trace towards them. However much the tzaddik loves Hashem, that's how much he hates, despises, and is disgusted in evil. Because disgust is exactly the opposite of love, just as hatred is the opposite of love. To be continued. You got a question? That's all? Question?
No. Well, I'm still collecting my thoughts.
Don't leave them here.
Okay.
Oh. I had a question posed to me the other day, and I asked someone else